Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. My name is David Kunzman, and I will be your host for today. Today we'll be talking with Gregory Harms, the author of No Politics, No Religion, How America's Code of Conduct Conceals Our Unity, published by Political Animal Press in 2022. Gregory has taught moral and political philosophy for the past decade at places such as Lewis University and Joliet Junior College in Illinois. His scholarship has had special focus on U.S. foreign policy and the Middle East. You can find Gregory's writings in places such as Counterpunch and Truthout. Gregory has also written titles such as The Palestine-Israel Conflict, A Basic Introduction, which is now in its fourth edition as of 2017. It's Not About Religion, published in 2012, and Straight Power Concepts in the Middle East, U.S. Foreign Policy, Israel, in World History, published in 2010. I've also had the pleasure of having Gregory Harms as my philosophy instructor at Joliet Junior College. And I hope you enjoy the interview for today. So we usually like to start our interviews by asking our guests just their current background and how they came to write their current book. So Gregory, how did you come to write No Politics, No Religion?
It started with a concern I had about how in this culture, maybe taken broadly, that it's become a code of conduct that I hear over and over and over again that, you know, these two topics are, you know, they've become like verboten. They've become, we were discouraged from talking about these topics of politics and religion. And I've talked to many students, and they report the same thing, that, you know, these topics are not welcome at the table or at the dinner table or at family, you know, events like Thanksgiving or something like this. And you're just not supposed to talk about them. And this is based on the premise that these topics are inherently destabilizing and inherently fraught with, you know, they'll invariably lead to conflict and bad feelings and bickering and so on and so forth. And I've been teaching for 10 years now, and we talk about politics and religion in the classroom, and we have for a decade, and I have never once had a student, you know, come unhinged and have a meltdown and people get angry, and it's never happened. You can have a rational, constructive conversation about these topics. It's how you approach them. It really is about how you approach them and what kind of intentions you're bringing to those topics. You know, if your point of departure is ideological, if your point of departure is, you know, I'm right and you're wrong, or, you know, I'm a conservative and you're a liberal, and therefore you're my, then there's automatically right out of the gate an adversarial sort of dynamic at work. And I just don't think that's a helpful or constructive way to approach these topics. These topics, based on my research, these topics, if handled correctly, if handled constructively, if handled rationally, can lead to greater agreement and greater harmony, and can emphasize the commonality that we share as humans, as Americans, and so on, you know. But it's all in the approach. That's what I have found.
So in the preface of the book, you mentioned, I guess, two images of America. You named them Accord America and Asunder America. And Accord America seems to be the America that's revealed by the public opinion polls. And why do you feel that Asunder America is the image that we're sort of bombarded with?
I think the population is constantly beat over the head with the wrong assumption that the nation's divided and Americans can't even agree on, you know, how many sides a triangle has. And this is patently false, you know, but they're told this, the population is told this routinely. And it's just drilled into the popular, it's drilled into the American imagination, and it's drilled into the population's picture of itself. And it's just not true, because you mentioned the public opinion polls. I mean, if you look at the public opinion polls, and I, believe me, I have, they tell a totally different story. But even like if it, like I read the New York Times religiously, you know, I read it every day. And you'll see it in the paper. You'll see it in the New York Times on a regular basis in one story or one, you know, editorial or one opinion column or something like this, or even on the front page, you know, they'll talk about how the country is divided and so on and so forth. And then like two columns over, there'll be an article about, you know, oh, well, according to a poll done by the Wall Street Journal and whoever, 64% of Americans are on the same page about, you know, whatever issue. And I'm like, I just find that astounding, that the message prevails despite the very clear data that the message is false. So you even within one newspaper, it's a major newspaper, but even within one paper, at the same time, on the same day, they send the message that Americans are divided, and they talk about they everything's couched in that assumption, and then the paper also reports that the majority, to a significant degree, are on the same page, that they're in agreement. Well, which is it? Well, I think we should look at the data and not the assumptions of some columnist or some reporter, you know. But this assumption that Americans are divided and the country is divided, it's taken root, like I said, in the American imagination, and that is our conception of ourselves now, is that the country is divided. The country is divided, yes, absolutely, when it comes to voting. I mean, you see it all the time, you know. Down to, you know, these elections, you know, for representative or senator or whoever, are down to the razor's edge. I mean, they're counting, you know, I mean, 500 votes could tip it one way or the other for an entire state. I mean, it's down to the edge. But yeah, so yes, the voting is split. The country's divided politically. I mean, that is to say, I would say ideologically divided, because we frame our we 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 frame our conversations about these things, you know, as Democrats, as liberals, you know, so on and so forth. And that's how we vote. But when the population goes to the polls, the population is not voting for its interests. It's voting, it's gone into what I call the blue-red circus tent. And when you go into the blue-red circus tent, you leave your actual wants and preferences at the door. And then you adopt this other artificial vocabulary that has been provided by Washington, D.C. And I think that's why the elections are always razor thin, is people are voting as Democrats, as liberals, and so on and so forth, you know, and they're also participating in a personality contest, which I think is dangerous in and of itself. But I think that's why the what I call in the preface, the, you know, asunder America, I think that's the one that gets all the attention, because that's how we behave. We're not voting our preferences. If we voted our preferences, Elizabeth Warren would be in the White House, you know, Bernie Sanders would be in the White House, not Joe Biden, you know, not Obama, not Trump, you know, these people wouldn't get anywhere near the White House if the population actually voted its material interests.
I believe the terminology used is the difference between polarization and divided. Is that right?
Yeah, polarization reflects, the former creates the latter. The polarization is how we, it's certainly a highly polarized country, no doubt about it, but that is in reference to how we talk about these things and how we frame our discussions, and, you know, how we divide one another up into liberals and conservatives. You know, if you utter one single sentence about politics in this country, someone within earshot will just rubber stamp what you just said as liberal or conservative or something like this. And it's even happened in Washington. You know, we used to have, you know, conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. You know, those days are over. You know, now they become synonymous. You know, to be Democrat is to be liberal, and to be Republican is to be conservative. They become perfectly synonymous in this very tight grouping around these two poles. And that's the phenomenon that you're seeing in elections and in the public discourse.
So in the next two chapters of your book, you try to give a philosophical grounding and a scientific grounding to make your case that America is more in accordance. So in the philosophical chapter, you start with the Enlightenment. You mentioned Shaftesbury, Butler, Smith, and Hume, mm-hmm. and Rousseau. And they seem to be pushing back against Hobbes. I guess the question for our listeners is, who was Hobbes, and why are these other figures pushing back against him?
The chapter of which you speak, when I talk about the philosophers, is really an analysis and a discussion of human nature and how we look at ourselves. And yeah, they did kind of gang up on Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes was an English philosopher, considered the founding father of, you know, modern political theory. He wrote the masterpiece Leviathan, and he's frequently mischaracterized as someone who was saying that, you know, humans are just terrible creatures that were prone to violence, and left to our own devices, we'll just tear one another limb from limb, you know. So then you've got all these Enlightenment thinkers, people like Rousseau, people like Adam Smith, people like David Hume, who really took issue with this and revolutionized how we look at humans and how we talk about human morality. They just flipped it on its head. And I found that very interesting, that, you know, the human being that Adam Smith is talking about and Rousseau, they emphasize that we are sympathetic, cooperative creatures, that we're not prone to violence and, you know, tearing each other apart, but we are motivated by sympathy and compassion, which is correct, because as I've said in the classroom, God knows how many times, now, if human beings were naturally vicious, if we were inherently or genetically or innately aggressive and greedy and competitive and backstabbing and all this stuff, there wouldn't be any humans. We wouldn't be here. The reason there are 8 billion human beings on this planet is because we tend to get along and we tend to cooperate. That's not to suggest that we're angels by any means, you know, but we tend to get along. We tend to cooperate more often than not. Yeah, human beings are capable of all kinds of really terrible actions and behaviors, but that's not representative of the species. You know, I've had the good fortune to do a fair amount of traveling, and you don't need to travel around the world much to see that. And it sounds facile and it sounds sort of precious, but I mean, people are really the same all over the world. They're not that different. I mean, they look different. They eat different food. They listen to different music, and they dress differently, and so on and so forth. But that's at the surface. You know, what do they actually want? They want to be left alone. You know, they want, you know, they want a job. They want a job that pays something. They more often than not try to get along with their neighbors. You know, yeah, people can be bad neighbors, but you just don't see aggression and viciousness when you travel around the world. You don't. That's representative. I mean, but the person who's acting badly, the person who's, you know, acting in a ridiculous, irrational way on a commercial flight, that's what gets the news. And then everybody watches it. And then people are like, oh, people are nuts. You know, people are out of their minds. You know, look at this person on flight such and such. You know, he's screaming at everybody and carrying on and threatening the flight staff and whatever. But okay, there's one person doing that. You know, but there's 200 people that aren't. There's 200 people that think, good Lord, why am I on the flight with this guy? You know, there's 200 people that aren't. And I think 200 is more important than one, but that's sort of how it's presented in, you know, in the news outlets. You know, you watch CNN, you're going to see people doing terrible things. You know, you're going to watch, you know, whatever, you know, you read the news and you're going to read about people doing terrible things, but those are very small numbers. These are not representative of the species. They're not, you know. You're not going to, but you're not going to turn on CNN and read about how, you know, so-and-so, you know, baked bread for their neighbor, you know, whatever, you made a cake or something. You're not going to hear about that. You're going to hear about the person who's, you know, acting like a lunatic on the airplane. That's all that'll make the news. Not baking a cake for your neighbor, you know, or helping your neighbor, you know, dig his car out of the snow or something like that. You know, you're not going to hear about that, but that's what happens a lot. That basically defines, if I can use that word, the species, is people helping one another, you know, get their cars unstuck in the snow or whatever. You know, that is human behavior. The person who's acting like a lunatic on the airplane, that's not representative of anything. That's just that one guy, you know. So I think we need to look at the big number, not the small number.
So in the science chapter, you give scientific examples of different disciplines, I guess, confirming Hume and Smith's sentiments of morality. Were you surprised by that when you first discovered that?
I I kept seeing it. I wasn't surprised because I thought these guys, these particular thinkers are onto something. But I kept seeing it, and I found that fascinating. You know, the amount of research that has gone into basically substantiating what these thinkers had to say. And I'd start, you know, if I found someone, I'd immediately buy his or her book and, you know, flip to the index just to see, you know, I'm like, yep, there they are. There's Hume, there's Smith, there's Rousseau. There, you know, that they're all, it's like Hume, it's kind of funny. It's like, you know, Hume has been dead for a very long time. He died in 1776. And he's the talk of the town. All these modern 21st century researchers, psychologists, anthropologists, neuroscientists, you know, the list goes on. They talk about Hume. And I just found that fascinating that I kept happening upon that. I kept reading the books, and I'm like, God, they keep talking about Hume. And I just thought that was fantastic. And I was really, fascinated with how these thinkers during the Enlightenment are being substantiated and commanding so much attention among these modern day 21st century researchers. And they're bearing them out. I mean, they're doing research on babies and, you know, infants and toddlers at Yale, and again and again and again, what Hume and Adam Smith and others had to say about human nature is being borne out in, you know, research labs and so on. Yeah, again and again. I just thought it was remarkable that all these scientists are talking about Adam Smith and David Hume. So I thought, God, someone needs to know about that. This is a story that really needs to be told. So I decided to tell it. And it leads right into the politics.
So you dedicate two chapters to religion, one being a very broad history of religion, starting from proto-religion rituals that the Neanderthals gave, from animism all the way up to monotheism. And the next chapter is dealing with, you feel that religion gets a bad rap, and you take on some of these figures known as the new atheists, Dawkins, Hitchens, and Harris. Why do you feel that religion gets a bad rap?
I think it's become a reflex to blame religion. You know, I've heard it a thousand times. Like, oh, you know, religion makes people stupid. You know, it encourages them to believe strange things, and it leads to violence. And people blame, you know, warfare, historical warfare, on religion. And I just don't think, if you look at the history, this is not borne out. It's not. Religion, humans seem to do spirituality of one kind or another. We seem to be sort of pre-programmed, I guess you might say. We seem to have a predilection or a natural sort of innate inclination toward the spiritual. Now, I wouldn't call what was going on in early human history, I wouldn't call that religion necessarily. You know, the animism of the foraging humans, you know, I wouldn't call that religion. I wouldn't call what humans were doing religion until much, much later. You know, when there's a scripture and these things became codified and organized, that's what I would call religion. You know, the oldest among them today, or the oldest. I mean, you could start the clock at maybe 3,000 years ago. Well, that's nothing. I mean, in human history, that's that's last week, you know. And so I think if you look at religion, you see this unifying, you see a unifying force. You don't see something that leads to bloodshed and violence. You see something that leads to commonality. And then these new atheists that you mentioned, you know, these people are just very proud and very impressed with themselves because they're atheists. And, you know, they go looking in the Quran and they go looking in the Bible for inconsistencies, and they approach these texts like they're physics textbooks. And they have those expectations of the Bible, which is ludicrous. I mean, obviously they don't know much about biblical history or the history of the Quran, where these texts came from. These texts were created in a particular context by particular authors, and they should not be approached like a physics textbook, because they are not. They're not that. They're not perfect. You can find whatever you're looking for in the Bible or in the Quran. Fine. If that's your agenda, you can find whatever you're looking for. But if you go to Mass and you visit a mosque in the Middle East, in the Arab world, you see people coming together, getting along, and using religion as a way to, you know, the assumption is that God expects his followers to be upright, to live a better life, to be a better person. You know, people who go to church on Sunday, they're not looking at the Bible like, oh, this is an interesting passage, so I'm justified in doing X, Y, and Z. You know, that's not what they're doing. They look at those parts of these texts. They focus on those parts that encourage uprightness and virtuousness, and those are the parts that get discussed by imams, by priests, you know, whomever, you know, that those are the parts that get emphasized, not everything else in the text. So again, it's contingent on an approach. What do you want to achieve? Now, these new atheists, they're very, you know, these are very self-impressed, self-congratulatory intellectuals who incidentally worshipped American state power. Okay, there's a quasi sort of religious character in how they worship American power, or American military power. That borders on the religious, but that never comes up in their conversations. I wouldn't call that religious behavior by any means, but they're perfectly free and willing to bow down and worship, you know, fighter jets and stuff like that.
What do you think separates, like, the old atheists, someone like Nietzsche, Freud, and Marx, from these new atheists?
Well, I think it's debatable whether Nietzsche was an atheist. I don't know if we know that, but I take your point. Those Nietzsche and Marx were doing a kind of analysis. They're doing analysis. They were philosophers. And Freud had his philosophical moments, of course, and Freud knew his philosophy. They were doing analysis, and they were trying to achieve something. Marx was talking about the, you know, industrial capitalism and the human misery that it is produced by human endeavor, by power relations. Nietzsche was focusing on, I couldn't say I agree with Nietzsche to the letter about his politics, but he's talking about he's basically a virtue ethicist. He's talking about being a better person. He just didn't have much use for Christianity. So fine, he's critical of Christianity. He's critical of Christianity at the level of, you know, at the level of moral philosophy. He didn't really have much to say about, you know, Christ being the Son of God and all this stuff. I don't think it really interested him much. He was just critical of the morality, and Nietzsche revolutionized how we look at human morality. Not the way Adam Smith did, but Nietzsche was more preoccupied with value systems than anything else. But these particular thinkers weren't thrilled with religion, but they didn't make it a villain. They didn't blame, you know, all this historical bloodshed on religion. They just didn't have a particular use for it in their separate analyses. And Hitchens and Harris and these guys, their agenda is themselves, presenting themselves as enlightened, and, you know, we're supposed to be very impressed with them as intellectuals. That doesn't describe Nietzsche and Marx at all. You know, Nietzsche and Marx had something to offer, and they helped us understand the world a little better. The four horsemen, as they've, you know, self-styled, they didn't bring anything to the world. They didn't help us understand anything except their own narcissism. That's all they had to see. That's all they seemed to offer. You know, does that answer your question, David?
Yeah, yeah. In the last part of the book, you bring up political language like liberal and conservative, socialism.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think we get wrong when we use those terms?
Well, in the public discourse, liberal means left, you know, and then conservative, I don't even really know what that word means anymore. I don't see anything conservative about American conservative politics. Liberal is not left. Liberal is a centrist political philosophy. It's at the dead center, and that is where the population lies. That is how you calibrate the political spectrum, is you focus on where does the population sit. Well, it sits at the center. Is where else are you going to put the center? If 67% of Americans, you know, agree on X, Y, and Z, then that's the center. You know, I mean, Bill Clinton doesn't define the center. Dick Cheney doesn't define the center. Donald Trump doesn't define the center. You know, the population defines the center. And so if we understand the concept of liberal better, then we know to move it to the center. And this tells us, this tells us and shows us something very interesting, because the population's at the center, both political parties, both major political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, are well to the right of the center. They both are. Now, there's probably more daylight between those two than there has been in decades past. There's more. The Democrats are moving to the left. That is correct. But I tell my students, you have to understand the second part. Otherwise, you'll never understand this stuff. So yes, that is correct. The Democrats are slowly moving to the left, toward the center. And the Republican Party is moving to the right, away from the center. And they're already right of center. The Republican Party is just moving further and further away from what the population wants. And the Democrats are moving closer to what the population wants. I mean, so if you take someone like Bernie Sanders, I mentioned earlier, you know, he's considered this leftist socialist. Well, he's neither. He's not a leftist. He's not one millimeter to the left of the population. And he's not a socialist. He can call himself a socialist all he wants, but he's not. You know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez can call herself a socialist, but she's not. She's not one millimeter to the left of the population either. Neither is Elizabeth Warren or whomever, you know. These aren't leftist politicians. We don't even have leftist politics in this country. I mean, there are some small parties. There are some small political parties that get like 3 votes. And, you know, they're Marxist or whatever. You know, even the Green Party, which is considered way left, it is not. If you look at the Green Party's actual positions on and where they stand, you know, their platform, they're a centrist party. I mean, they use some leftist language occasionally. That's just the rhetoric they prefer. If you look at their actual concrete positions on different things, they're centrist. So all of these, you know, all in, you know, Green Party, Bernie Sanders, AOC, you know, Elizabeth Warren, these are all centrist people. This is centrist politics we're talking about. And then people like Clinton, both Clintons, Bill and Hillary, Obama, Joe Biden, you know, they're all cut from the same bolt, and they're all to the right. They're all Republicans. They're all operationally what Republicans used to be in the 70s. That's all they are. They're nothing more. And they've all been branded as progressive leftists, which is a joke. You know, the New York Times has no patience for Bernie Sanders. You know, but the New York Times is very protective of the Clintons and of Joe Biden and of the sort of old guard, you know, these Democrats that are operationally Republicans, what the Republicans were in like in the 70s. They're very protective of them, and they've helped to frame this conversation, which is totally wrong. If you want to talk about what the population wants, if you want to talk about centrist politics, then you got to talk about Bernie, and you got to talk about Elizabeth Warren. What's Obama got to do with anything? Did we get universal health care? No. We got the Affordable Care Act, which was forged in the which was forged at the Heritage Foundation. It's a Republican policy initiative. That's why the Republicans hate it, because it's their plan. He just took it and ran with it. Did we see deep substantive reform on Wall Street? No. They're all Wall Street friendly. Obama was Wall Street friendly. Trump, Mr. Drain the Swamp, he's Wall Street friendly. Biden, a friend of mine made me laugh fairly recently. He described Biden as an old Communist Party apparatchik who the party has decided can be general secretary finally. You know, that's all Biden. That's all Biden is. You know, I thought it was really funny that he put it in those terms. Yeah, the party has decided that Biden can be general secretary.
So at the end of the book, you give a chapter, what can we do? So what can we do about this polarization that we're facing now?
The thing I principally advocate, I guess is the word, is we need to talk to one another. I know that sounds sort of like a non-answer, but that really is the answer. We need to talk to one another, and we need to not be afraid of these two topics, politics and religion. We just need to approach them with a different mindset and discuss them in a constructive way. And start the conversation with where we agree, which is most of the time. you know, I mean, the reason your uncles bicker is they've already decided that the other person is, you know, their opponent or something, you know. Yeah. I watch this news program, he watches that news program, he's a liberal, I'm a conservative. They have these ideological battles using words they, my observation, don't understand, which is a terrible way to start a conversation. It's not a conversation, really. It's just two people yelling at one another or bickering about ideological labels that they don't understand. That's not a conversation. That's not a debate. I mean, if you look at the polling data, there's plenty for us to agree on, you know. So start the conversation there. Start the conversation with where we agree. And as for, you know, arguing about news programs like, you know, oh, I prefer Fox or, you know, I've noticed that it's very common for Americans to associate whatever their news preference is with what they like. So I teach on three different college campuses, and you know, I'll be sitting around reading the New York Times, and I've had students, plural, kind of, you know, walk up to me and ask me, why do you like the New York Times? I mean, that question tells us a lot. So if I'm reading the New York Times, I automatically like the New York Times. So you have to like your news source. So if I watch Fox, I like Fox. If I watch CNN, I like CNN. I think that's, I'm glad the students came up to me and talked, you know. But I mean, in general, I think that's a pretty juvenile mindset. Who says you gotta like the news source you're tuning into or reading? You know, it's just a news source. You don't like your bank. You know, you don't like JP Morgan Chase. You just happen to bank there. You know, or maybe you had lousy customer service someplace else or whatever. But you don't bank at Chase because you like Chase. You know. You just bank there. So then you have certain expectations of the bank, you know, how they manage your money, how do they operate as an organization, so on and so forth. You have certain expectations of them. But you don't know who the president of your bank is. How many people know who the CEO of JP Morgan Chase is? Not many. But Americans have highly personalized politics and news sources, news outlets. It's become a very personal thing. You know, I like this candidate. I like this news source. But, you know, and then they judge the various candidates at election time according to, you know, those criteria. Like, who do I like? Well, I don't like her laugh. I don't like his, I don't trust his face. I mean, they're judging these candidates by very superficial criteria instead of trying to match where you actually stand on political issues and where, you know, politician A, B, or C stands on those same issues. That's how you evaluate a candidate, by where they stand on the issues that are important to you, and are they somewhere in the vicinity of your preferences? Who cares if you like them or not? That's not what they're there for. They're there to do a job. And hopefully do the job, somewhere in the vicinity of your political preferences. So I think we need to depersonalize politics and the news and communicate with one another at the level of preference, where we agree, and dispense with this ideological with this ideological identification, you know, I've decided I'm a liberal, so I have to, everything passes through that filter or prism, you know. If you're using those labels and you're leaning on those labels, then you're really not even thinking. You're just wearing a jersey. You're just cheering. You're just rooting for a team, and then right off the bat, you're not thinking. You know, how can we have a conversation when one party's not thinking? You can't. So, just use your own language, and talk about what your preferences are, and try to find some common ground with your interlocutor, with the person with whom you're speaking. Try to find some common ground. Start with where you agree, not with where you don't, and dismiss the whole liberal conservative nonsense. Those you can have a perfectly rational, productive conversation about politics and never once use those words. I practice this in my day-to-day life. You could have a conversation, David, you and I could have a conversation about politics that could last 3 hours long, and you'll never hear those words come out of my mouth, not once. You don't need them, you know. I don't even use those words. And I study, you know, political philosophy. I mean, I know what those words mean. I know what classical liberalism is. I've read my John Locke, and I know what conservatism is. I've read my Edmund Burke. So I mean, I've got a background in these writings, and I know what those words mean, but I don't use them. I don't use them. They're of no use to me in articulating my political preferences and what I want to see and what I, you know, and what I want for the country. So that I guess if I had a advice or a suggestion about how to proceed, I think that would be it, to not talk about these things in such a charged, antagonistic way, and then you can have a conversation, you know.
So I guess in regarding someone's personal political self-development, and they feel themselves trapped in maybe an ideological silo, do you have any recommendations or tips how one can get themselves out of said silo?
I guess just stop using the words. You know, just stop. Stop using those. You can just, I know it might take a while to get used to it, but I mean, you can just stop using them. You know, if you start using those words, you get trapped into that polarity. You get trapped into arguing someone else's point. You know, those terms are what they use on Capitol Hill, you know. I mean, if you're arguing as a Democrat or as a Republican, then you're not arguing your own position. And why would you adopt someone else's vocabulary and someone else's preferences? The Democratic Party and the Republican Party do not represent American preferences. They don't. So if you're using their language and you're thinking their thoughts, then you've left your own preferences behind. You've abandoned your own preferences. So I would just say, I mean, just don't use that language. You don't need to use that language. That's someone else's language. And I think it's really important for your listeners to bear in mind that both parties, blue and red, do not represent this country. They represent themselves, and they represent their lobbyists. But they don't represent their constituents. They don't. The polling data is crystal clear on this. There's no room for debate. The polling data is what it is, and both parties are to the right of the population, significantly. There's probably more daylight between the two major parties at this point, but that's not saying much. That's not really saying much. And the Republicans have moved so far to the right, and they're moving moving farther to the right, and they're so remote from what the working class wants and what the middle class wants that I don't know if they have a future in American politics. the Democrats, I think I mentioned this earlier, the Democrats are moving to the left. That's correct. But they're moving to the left toward the center. They're moving toward popular opinion, public opinion. They're moving toward it. So to say they're moving toward the left, there are a number of their opponents on Capitol Hill who would paint the Democrats as becoming some kind of Marxist socialist party, which is a joke. I mean, it can't be taken seriously. They are moving to the left, that is true, but toward the center, toward public opinion. So I think don't use those words. Don't just ignore the language used on Capitol Hill, and bear in mind the opinion polls. Think your own thoughts. I guess that's my best advice. Would be to think your own thoughts, and don't allow Washington D.C. to trick you into adopting their language, which is what your uncles are doing when they're bickering. They're just arguing between that space, that very narrow space between the parties, between the Democrats and the Republicans. That whole space, but that space between the two parties is to the right. It's far to the right of the population and what the population wants. So I guess does that answer your question, David?
Yeah, I guess how would you recommend people finding, news sources with substantive content that don't use these highly charged language? Because it seems like the news media has become almost an entertainment wing of cable news or something like that.
Yeah, a lot of them use it. I mean, it's hard to get away from it. You just have to sort of filter it out as you're reading, hopefully you're reading your news. As for televised news in this country is terrible. You got CNN, which is terrible. You got Fox, which is, they would have to come up to terrible. And then you got the network news like Channel 5 and Channel 7. They're not even, that's just embarrassing. They're not doing the country a service. They're not informing the country. No educated society would tolerate those news programs for a minute. They'd be laughed out of existence. Definitely read your news over watching your news. I tell students this all the time. And then as for print news, if I had to, recommend a sort of a morning roundup, if you will, I would say, even though I am very critical of it, I would definitely say the New York Times. That's not to say that I have some great love for the New York Times. I certainly don't. I've written about this. I'm very critical of that newspaper. But I would still, nevertheless, say read the New York Times every morning. I find The Guardian, which is a British news organization, I find The Guardian very informative and helpful. There are independent sources like Democracy Now. They have a radio station, a podcast. They're on television. They got a website. You can watch videos. You can click on all the stuff that they do on their show. Democracy Now has done excellent work for many years now. Democracy Now! And their host, Amy Goodman, very informative. They have experts and scholars on, and they interview them, and you can actually learn something watching Democracy Now! imagine that. You could watch CNN 10 hours a day, 7 days. You could just quit your job and just watch CNN for the rest of your life, and you won't know in 10 years after watching CNN 7 days a week, you won't know any more about the Middle East than you did when you started. That's because the coverage is ridiculously bad. But you can watch Democracy Now! and listen to interviews and listen to people who know what they're talking about. People like Rashid Khalidi, people like Noam Chomsky, you know, people like Hanan Ashrawi. You can listen to, you know, they'll interview these people and you can learn something. You can learn something about, you know, what's going on in the Palestinian territories that you'll never hear on CNN. Never, ever. So I definitely recommend Democracy Now. Another website that I highly recommend, I recommend it to students all the time, is the explainer website, VOX.com. They take what's in the news, like the major stories, and then they explain it in plain language, you know, plain, you know, clear English. And they do very good work. Their coverage on, I don't think he's still there, but Herman Lopez, did excellent coverage of, you know, gun control and gun violence and issues like that. I think he's at the New York Times now, but, nevertheless, Vox does very good work. I'm continually impressed with the work they do. Yeah, I would say that, yeah, New York Times, Guardian, Democracy Now, and Vox. I would start there. Yeah, that's four. That's easy to remember. Yeah, but I mean, students ask me all the time, you know, they're like, they're looking for this perfect news source. And, well, I got bad news for you. Yeah, there is no, you know, magic bullet. There's no perfect news source. They all have flaws. They all lean. They all have the shortcomings. They are organizations producing a product, you know. The New York Times, they're flawed up one side and down the other. But for domestic coverage, they're pretty good. You can learn something. When it gets into foreign affairs and international coverage, it can, well, depending on the topic, they can, I don't know. Their Middle East coverage, their coverage of Israel is very Israel friendly. So you don't get a clear picture of what's going on in the Palestinian territories, because, you know, the people who write for the New York Times, they know better. They know that, you know, a certain type of article is not gonna pass the editor's desk. They know the rules, you know. If you're going to write about Israel, you're going to need to write about Israel with, you know, velvet gloves on. And, you know, you got to handle Israel very carefully. There's kind of a general rule in the New York Times about writing, reporting on allies. You know, you're going to report on Saudi Arabia, you got to go real easy, you know, kid gloves, as they call them. You got to go easy with allies. With enemies, you can say whatever you want. You can say whatever you want. You want to write an article about Hamas, you could make stuff up. Nobody cares. Yeah. But if you're writing about Israel, you got one comma out of place and the readership will just, you know, become apoplectic. You know, they just lose it. Yeah. But if you want to write an article about Hamas or Hezbollah or someone like that, yeah, you can. Nobody cares. You can just say what you want. You want to write about Russia or China? Fine. Say whatever you want. You know, you can be critical. You can describe them in, you know, forensic detail, but you can't describe Israel in that kind of detail. You can't say what they're up to. You can say what the Russians are up to. You can't say what the Israelis are up to. You know, there's a code of conduct if you're a journalist at the New York Times. And it's taken quite seriously, and you will find yourself without a career if you go rogue, you know. Yeah, it won't be tolerated. Nevertheless, I do recommend that people read the New York Times. It is an important newspaper because of the people who are reading it, primarily. It's a very important newspaper.
I was going to say, any conservative news media with any substantive content that you recommend?
I would say, I would say The Economist, or maybe The Wall Street Journal. I mean, they're kind of quote unquote. I think the Economist just comes out and says that they're conservative, you know, quote unquote. Whatever. I don't even know what that word means anymore. But I would say the Economist it's worth looking at the Economist. It's definitely worth looking at the Wall Street Journal. Their op-ed page is a little too far to the right for my tastes, but they have very good reportage. They have very good journalism going on in the financial press. That goes for the Financial Times as well. I would check those out for sure.
So before we go, we usually like to ask our guests if they're working on anything currently.
What was the last part again, David?
I was going to say, before we go, we usually like to ask our guests what they're working on currently.
Oh, okay. I have a new book in the works, another book. It's a collection of essays, and right now, this might change, but right now, a memoir plus a collection of essays. So we'll see. That might change. I've also got an essay on philosopher Thomas Hobbes. I just submitted an essay on Jean-Paul Sartre for publication. And I'm working right now on a book review on Nicholas Spencer's forthcoming Magisteria. So that's keeping me busy. You know, those are essays in the new book, yeah.
Gregory Harms, thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you, David.